And the first one you mentioned was Jackie Robinson breaking the color barrier in 1947. That's an important moment in American history. It's 2 years before Harry S. Truman desegregates the armed forces. And when I was at Columbia 50 years ago, where I earned my doctoral degree, I had an African-American historian professor of mine who said, for minority groups, wars and sports are community-defining situations. In other words, if you're allowed to play for your country, your team, your town, your city, or fight for your city or town or country, it's an important moment in terms of the integration of a minority group in society. So based upon that experience for African Americans, I projected it onto the story of Marty Glickman, because Marty Glickman tries to make it in the sports world, and the community defines him as an insider, and then tragically as an outsider in a number of different areas. So it's a sports book, but it's also an American Jewish history book.
From Bookworms in the Wild and from Spotify, I'm Howard Alterescu, and this is my podcast, where I ask people I find interesting to tell me what they're reading. Before welcoming today's guest, here's what I've recently read and recommend. There's more detail on my website, www.bookwormsinthewild.com. All the Light We Cannot See by Anthony Doerr. My brother Lewis was recently reading this 2015 winner of the Pulitzer Prize for fiction, so I picked it up as well. This really good World War II era novel includes at least a dozen characters who are some combination of compelling, endearing, sympathetic, and in some cases, despicable, characters in Paris, Nazi Germany, and in Saint-Malo on the Breton coast in France. Author Anthony Doerr depicts the perils, duplicity, violence, and carnage of war, along with a beautiful, warm personal story. Highly recommended. Why We Love Baseball by Joe Poznanski. This one was joyous. Ben gave it to me for my birthday, absolutely loved it. From Jackie Robinson breaking the color barrier to Hank Aaron breaking the home run record, Gehrig's unsurpassable consecutive game record surpassed by Cal Ripken. DiMaggio's hitting streak, shoeless Joe Jackson and the 1919 World Series Black Sox scandal, Don Larsen's World Series perfect game, Kurt Gibson's dramatic, gimpy walk-off World Series home run, Babe Ruth's supremacy, Ted Williams' excellence, Yogi Berra's greatness, over-the-shoulder Willie Mays, Satchel Paige and Josh Gibson, Bobby Thompson's shot heard round the world, aided by Herm Frank's behind the outfield scoreboard, the great Sandy Koufax, Jim Abbott's phenomenal no-hitter, Mr. November, Derek Jeter, the Buckner tragedy for Boston, the Mazeroski tragedy of my youth, Mickey Mantle, the hero of my youth, and many others, including, of course, Shohei Ohtani. Great fun. Thanks, Ben. And speaking of sports, my guest today, Jeffrey Gurok, is the author of a great new comprehensive biography of the premier voice of New York sports from the 1940s through the 1990s. The book is Marty Glickman, The Life of an American Jewish Sports Legend. Jeff is a professor of Jewish history at the Graduate School of Jewish Studies of Yeshiva University and is an internationally recognized expert in the discipline of American Jewish history, with special interest in the history of American Judaism, the history of New York Jewry, and Judaism and American sports. Jeff has written over a dozen books in the field of American Jewish history. Jeff's New York City bona fides are exemplified by his CCNY bachelor's degree, his graduate degrees from Columbia, and in his participation in the New York City Marathon 12 times. Jeff, I loved your book. Welcome to the podcast.
Well, thank you very much. Listening to your introduction, talking about all those great sports moments, reminds me of one of the aspects of this book. You know, I'm 74 years old, and Marty Glickman was the voice of my youth growing up. in New York City. I still sound like a New Yorker. And I was, you know, one of those kids who listened to Marty Glickman with a transistor radio with an earplug under the covers, listening to Marty Glickman's accounts. I was one of those kids where Marty Glickman once, during a football Giant game, told fans to open the windows of their tenements or apartments and yell out, "Go Giants, go! Go Giants, go!" So I went to the window, opened the window, and started screaming. And my father says, What the hell are you doing? I said, "Marty Glickman told me to yell, 'Go Giants, go! Go Giants, go!'" You know, when I played basketball in the street and made a good basket, I would say swish because Marty Glickman said swish. And you know, Howard, before Marv Albert said yes, or Mike Breen said bang, or Iron Eagle said book it, you had Marty Glickman, and he was a teacher to all those people. So, you know, one of the aspects of the book is to bring back for my audience a very different era of New York sports. For example, it was an era where we really had professional football in New York City, two great teams, the Giants and the Jets, and Marty Glickman broadcasted for both of them. So half of the book, or a portion of the book, is a sports history of New York City and, of course, the United States. But as you were kind enough to mention, I'm a professional historian, and I always say I was out for more game when talking about Marty Glickman, because there's a very Jewish aspect to his, there are many Jewish aspects to his life as a second generation Jew growing up in the Flatbush section of Brooklyn, who tried very hard to make it in the American world and was stymied by a whole set of anti-Semitic incidents, some of which are very well known to people, and others that I felt obliged and interested to relate to people as well. So it's a sports book for sports fans, but it's also a book on American Jewish history for people who have no interest in sports and but want to know what the American Jewish experience was all about. So that's why I wrote a book about Marty Glickman. A great voice, you know, but also someone who's very important in terms of American Jewish history. And let me say one other thing. You rattled off a whole bunch of moments in time that are very important in terms of sports, right? And the first one you mentioned was Jackie Robinson breaking the color barrier in 1947. That's an important moment in American history. It's 2 years before Harry S. Truman desegregates the armed forces. And when I was at Columbia 50 years ago, where I earned my doctoral degree, I had an African-American historian professor of mine who said, "For minority groups, wars and sports are community-defining situations." In other words, if you're allowed to play for your country, your team, your town, your city, or fight for your city or town or country, it's an important moment in terms of the integration of a minority group in society. So based upon that experience for African Americans, I projected it onto the story of Marty Glickman, because Marty Glickman tries to make it in the sports world, and the community defines him as an insider, and then tragically as an outsider in a number of different areas. So it's a sports book, but it's also an American Jewish history book.
Oh, very much so. So starting out, when I read the introduction, when I read the title, Marty Glickman, The Life of American Jewish Sports Legend, I hearkened back as well to his voice as a sports commentator. I more so listened to baseball, and also with a transistor radio under my pillow, listening to Yankee games at night. But your book is so much more than a sports book. It is a terrific sports book. But Marty Glickman's life and the way you tell the story of his life tells a much broader story. You write at one point, the Jewish sports experience in the United States can be used as a metaphor for narrating how Jews, their culture, and religion have progressed and have been challenged within American society. Why don't you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. For me, it's very, as a historian, it's very important that we understand that sports is, participation in sports the ability to play sports and your interest in sports helps define you as an American. And that's one of the conflicts that exists between parents and children within the American Jewish experience. And then the question is, are you accepted as an American through the metaphor of sports? And for the first 17 years of Marty Glickman's life as an outstanding athlete growing up in Brooklyn in a very well integrated neighborhood of ethnic groups, there are Germans, there are Irish, there are Italians, no African Americans, segregated neighborhood. He's very comfortable and he's growing as an athlete. Then he goes to James Madison High School in Brooklyn, which is a predominantly Jewish school. He's very comfortable being a Jew in an environment where I call it an ethnic religious cocoon. But then he tries to enter, and he does enter into the American world outside of Brooklyn. First, he goes to Syracuse University. Remarkable story. Syracuse University was one of the many schools in this country at that point which had quotas against Jews. They didn't want too many Jews on campus. A group of fraternity brothers, the SAMIs, the SAM fraternity, recruit Glickman because they have this quixotic dream that if you bring a great Jewish athlete to campus and he wins as a runner and as a football player, track man, a football player, it will make life better for Jews on campus. It turns out that Monty Glickman exhausts my speaking knowledge of Latin. He's persona non grata honoris causa, which means he's someone who's not really wanted, but honored because of his ability. So first 17 years of his life, he's skirting around all the anti-Semitism of that era. So if you're interested in studying anti-Semitism on campuses during the interwar period, look at the Monty Glickman story. It tells you a lot. But then he goes to Germany. He goes with the American Olympic team, and he's a great runner. And this is the story that a lot of people know about. And from my point of view, more people have to know about. He's on the American Olympic team, goes to Germany, gets to Germany. He feels that he's very well accepted. In fact, when he gets to the Olympic Village and he sees a Nazi guard there, he speaks a few words of Yiddish to him. And the German policeman responds in German. He's doing very well. He goes to the stadium to watch some events. He hitches a ride with another Jewish athlete named Herman Goldberg, who played in an exhibition game of baseball. By the way, Howard, the game was so boring for the German crowd that they walked out on the game. They hitch a ride with this German person who happens to be a lieutenant in the Wehrmacht. Everything's going great. Until what he calls the meeting a day before the race, where he's supposed to run in a 4x100-meter relay race, the last event in the Olympics, in the Olympic Stadium, in front of 80,000 fans, including Adolf Hitler, Hermann Göring, Joseph Goebbels, and others. A day before the race, he's taken off the team along with a forgotten other Jewish athlete named Sam Stoller, because the American coaches don't want to embarrass Hitler by having a Jew win a gold medal in this big stadium. And the fellow behind this, who's causing this problem, is a man named Avery Brundage. And I want my audiences to know who Avery Brundage was. He was an American Nazi. He was an anti-Semite. And I mentioned in the book, in 1936, Brundage is the head of the American Olympic Committee. It was important for me to mention, because it was so important to Marty Glickman, and I guess important to me, that 36 years later, Avery Brundage is still around. Not only that, he's the head of the International Olympic Committee. And as many people have forgotten, 11 Israeli athletes are murdered by Palestinian terrorists.
1972.
And Avery Brundage says the games must go on. So that's Avery Brundage. Again, if you want to understand the phenomenon of international anti-Semitism, one of the things you can do is by reading the story of Marty Glickman and Avery Brundage and all those people who kept them off the team, and the fact that the games go on and Marty Glickman realizes for the first time in his life how marginalized Jews can be. And to quote Marty Glickman, nobody died in 1936. But he calls it a prequel to the Holocaust. Again, as I'm talking to you, we're not talking about sports. We're talking about the experience of an American Jew. And I might say one other thing about Avery Brundage. On vacation last year, I picked up a book, a biography of Jim Thorpe, the great Indian-American runner, written by David Marinus, a Pulitzer Prize winning author. Turns out 1912, Jim Thorpe wins gold medals at the Stockholm Games, and he's stripped of his medals because he's accused, perhaps correctly, of playing some semi-pro baseball. Who's involved with this? The young Avery Brundage. And Avery Brundage, by the way, is a member of the German-American Bund. He speaks at their rallies at Madison Square Garden. And the other coaches are also anti-Semitic. It's a good platform, if you will, for studying anti-Semitism through the metaphor of sports and through the personality of one very well-known announcer, Marty Glickman. Opening chapter, I call him Sportscaster, Athlete, American Jew. So that's what the book is all about.
And you tell the story in a very compelling way. You set it up, I think, perfectly. He grew up, you said it was a diverse neighborhood, which I'm sure it was, but it also, as I understand it, never experienced anti-Semitism growing up. He was in pretty much a cocoon going through high school.
Through high school. There is an anti-Semite named Charles Coghlan, Father Coghlan, very well known to historians. He sends a group of people to rally in Flatbush, where Glickman lived. Coghlan's people are kicked out of the neighborhood. They want to hear about this. A lot of anti-Semitism out there in the world, but that's not the experience of Marty Glickman. And then when Glickman comes back after this terrible experience, and by the way, one of the things I pointed out and that I researched was how did the American media, the Jewish and the general media, react to Marty Glickman's being sidelined? It's the third or fourth story in the coverage of the Olympics. Nobody cares. Nobody cares. He's marginalized. And then Glickman comes back to New York, and he's about to go to Syracuse. And I should point out, by the way, that when the coaches tell Glickman that he's not going to run, Jesse Owens stands up and says, hey, wait a minute. Let these boys run. I have 3 gold medals already. And the coaches say, boy, sit down. That's the way African-Americans were referred to. That's the way athletes were referred to. Anyway, Glickman comes back to New York, and he's an Olympic athlete. He's invited by a friend of his to go and work out at the New York Athletic Club that's south of Central Park. And he gets to the door, and he's turned away by the director because Marty Glickman is a Jew. Now, if you want to study social anti-Semitism in the United States in the 1930s, look at the story of Marty Glickman. And Howard, I have to tell you something that's not in the book, but it's very personal. My father was an athlete. He wrestled. He was an amateur wrestler. He changed his name, by the way, from Jack Gourock to Jack Austin because he didn't want his immigrant parents to know that he became a wrestler. And he wrestled for the 92nd Street YMHA, which is on the east side of Manhattan to this day. They had a meet against the New York Athletic Club, and my father stole a towel from the New York Athletic Club. We called it the purloined towel. And we had it in our home for many years. This is as close as a Jew could get to be in the New York Athletic Club. Sadly, when my folks passed away, we lost that towel. But it's part of my memory. So although I don't mention my parents in the book, I'm thinking about Marty Glickman being turned away as an outstanding athlete because he's a Jew. Again, this is not about sports. It's about the American Jewish experience. By the way, the end of his life, Glickman becomes quite famous, and he's begged by the New York Athletic Club to become a member. By then, this is the 1970s, I guess, they've now opened their doors to women, African-Americans, and Jews. And of course, I shouldn't say of course, but Marty Glickman does not do that. He speaks at a dinner and tells the story so everyone can remember what happened to him. And I feel in my own way, I'm telling the world what happened to Marty Glickman and to so many other Jews during that time period. So again, it's a good sports book, but more importantly, it's a book about American Jews.
Now, on the subject of American Jews and how anti-Semitism was dealt with, as you said, the newspapers did not highlight the exclusion of the Jews from the 4x100 competition at the 1936 Olympics. But many Jewish athletes chose not to go to the Olympics. And a number of journalists and others opposed Jewish athletes going to the Olympics. Why did Marty go to the Olympics?
Well, two things. One, he's 17 years old. He's a kid at that point, okay? He's not totally attuned to the controversies that surrounded the boycott movement. But more importantly, the issue for Jewish athletes, and I guess for African-American athletes, but more for Jewish athletes, is if I go and I win, I make an important statement about the masculinity of Jews, about our ability to compete on the world stage, and in some respects, just the way Jesse Owens and Ralph Metcalf and Mack Robinson, just happened to be Jackie Robinson's brother, make a statement about what, where African Americans fit in the racist world of Hitler. We're going to go to Berlin and we're going to succeed and we're going to achieve and we're going to say something about where Jews fit in the world. Well, he finds out where Jews fit in the world. They're outsiders, caused by desire on the part of the American Olympic Committee to marginalize these Jews and not to offend their good friends in Berlin. One of the coaches of the Olympic team, of the track team, was a man named Dean Cromwell. Very interesting. Dean Cromwell also was a speaker at German-American rallies. He was one of the people who marginalized Marty Glickman. I'm pleased to tell you that recently, notwithstanding all the problems we have in America today, that the track stadium at the University of Southern California, where he was the track coach, they removed his name from the track stadium as a statement of recognition of where he was in terms of anti-Semitism in 1936. And Howard, I have to tell you I think it's the best story about the book that's not in the book, okay? So, you know, as an author, as a writer, I'd love to sell a lot of books, but I gave a copy of the book to a young rabbi in Los Angeles a few months ago who was invited by the USC track team to speak about anti-Semitism before this track team, made up primarily of African-American men and women, were going to go, and they did go, to Auschwitz on a consciousness-raising tour.
Wow.
And he goes and makes the speech, and he brings my book with him, and he tells the story of Marty Glickman in 1936. And there's silence in the room, and people are very moved by what he said. So I thought a lot about that story, and that is 1936, USC track team conspires to keep Marty Glickman and Sam Stoller off the track meet. With all the problems we face in America, and they are legion today, I'm not a Pollyanna, I'm not undermining. The fact of the matter is that the USC track team goes to Auschwitz and uses Marty Glickman's story as a metaphor for the experience of Jews during that time. You know, the way I describe the book as a sportscaster, athlete, American Jews, but also a teacher towards the end of his life, he hooks up with the U.S. Holocaust Museum, Holocaust Memorial Museum, and he travels the country talking about anti-Semitism and what happened to him. So it lives on in a very positive way through that Marty Glickman experience. So in retrospect, he's 17 years old. Most American Jews do not support the boycott. It has a lot to do with the passivity,
right,
and the fears of American Jews. There is a General Sherrill, Sherrill, says, if that boycott exists, it's going to redound negatively to Jews. So there's a lot of anti-Semitism around Glickman at that point. He, as a kid, has a driving ambition to go to the Olympics and thinks he can make a statement. And ironically, the statement that is made is, fella, you're an outsider. It says a lot about what American Jews are like during that very difficult time period.
Yeah, one of the quotes in the book, you quote him as saying, there was never any question about going to Germany. Ever since I realized I could run fast, I aspired above all to be an Olympian. And then you said, no one told him not to go. And I can understand what you're saying, all of it, is but especially perhaps being a 17-year-old with this kind of a goal.
But you know what, Howard? You know, it bespeaks the passivity of American Jews and their own marginality.
Yes.
I just mentioned in passing that I looked at what the American Jewish media of that time had to say about Stoller and Glickman being marginalized. And one of the newspapers, I think it's a Minneapolis newspaper, which had the distinction of choosing a annual Jewish All-American football team that Marty Glickman was on at least for 3 years. They said, well, you know, this was a difficult thing for Marty and Sam. They took it like men and they moved on. And that's how American Jews dealt with anti-Semitism in terms of their lack of activism. Later on in their lives, things begin to change. But in the 1930s, again, it says a lot through the sports metaphor of where we were at that particular time period.
The developments at USC, taking Dean Cromwell's name off the stadium and the track team going to Auschwitz and being guided by your book, that's a long time after 1936, but those are wonderful developments.
Right. If I go to a second edition, I will add that to the narrative, but it says a lot. And, you know, there are some positive things to note, too. Towards the end of the book, I talk about many of the disciples of Marty Glickman, names that are well known to everyone. I mentioned a few moments ago the Marv Alperts, the Spencer Rosses, the Mike Breens, all these others. But I have a special feeling, positive feeling, towards Bob Costas. Bob Costas, as you probably know, is one of the great broadcasters, sportscasters of our time. And he did something in 2012, which is in the book, which I want people to remember. 2012, the Olympics. And again, the Olympics had never been favorably disposed towards Jews, that's for sure, down to the present day, or towards Israel, down to the present day. 2012, the Israeli national team, Olympic team, and the London Jewish community wanted the IOC to recognize its 40 years since the murdering of Israeli athletes, and they refused. But Bob Costas, who was anchoring the march in ceremony, the Olympic at the Olympics?
Was that for NBC?
For NBC, yes. As the Israeli national team marched in, he went off script and said, "I want everyone to know who these people are and what happened to them." And after 10 seconds of saying that, they went to a commercial. By that time, Marty Glickman, who died in 2001. Had passed away. He was dead 11 years. But I project in the book that had he still been alive, he would be awfully pleased that one of his guys, who happens to be of Greek-American extraction, not a Jew, stood up very strongly for Jewishness and for the Israeli national team. And that's a very important moment. And that made it into the book. Again, I can't quote Marty Glickman because he was dead by then. But certainly we know that the 1972 event, that atrocity, loomed very large in his own consciousness down to the day he died in 2001 at age 83.
Right. So you mentioned Marty Glickman being a mentor to Bob Costas and others. I made a list: Marv Albert, Bob Costas, Len Berman, Sal Marciano, Spencer Ross, and then Bill Walton. That's an interesting story in the book. And Bill Walton, well known among people of our age. I don't know if others know him, but that's a wonderful story.
Yeah, sure. Before I mention Bill Walton, let me mention Gail Sarans, the first woman to broadcast an NFL game.
Right.
And recently I was watching a basketball game, and Beth Mowins, M-O-W-I-N-S, who's also one of Glickman's disciples, and Sam Marciano, that's Sal Marciano's daughter. So he was also one of the first to invite women, train women to be announcers. But you're right. I guess my favorite story in the entire book doing this research is, you know, first how I did this research. Once I got an email of one of these announcers, I asked for the emails of other announcers. And then I sent them a note, an email that says, "My name is Jeff Gurach. I'm a professor of Jewish history. I have a contract with NYU Press, and I'm not looking for any money. If you want to speak to me, email me or call me. And if 2 days go by and I don't hear from someone, obviously they are not interested. But I get a call back from Bill Walton almost immediately. He says, I got to speak to you. I said, fine. It took us a while for us to connect because he's traveling. And he says to me, this little guy, 5'8", Marty Glickman, of course, Walton 7 feet tall. He's one of the most important people in my life. I said, what about John Wooden, your great coach? He said, Wooden was very important, but so was Glickman. I said, what did Glickman mean to you? He said, you probably don't know this, although we do know this from a recent HBO special about Walton, that he stuttered and stammered as a kid. And Glickman had the same problem, and he worked with Walton, and now Walton is an Emmy-winning announcer for college basketball. When Glickman died, they interviewed John Wooden and asked him, what do you think of Marty Glickman? And he said, I got some problems with Glickman. I was shocked by it. What's the problem? He taught Walton how to speak, and now Walton never shuts up. That's how the chapter ends. So Bill Walton was someone who, you know, I didn't know he was a disciple of Marty Glickman, but towards the end of his life, Glickman becomes Professor Marty Glickman, where he teaches sports broadcasting at Fordham University. And sitting in my study here in Riverdale, looking out the window, I can see Fordham University, and they give an award every year to the most outstanding broadcasting student. They give him the Marty Glickman Award. So Marty Glickman, there's a chapter called Marty as Mentor, about all the people he influenced and trained. And again, they continue his legacy, even though they don't say swish, they say yes or bang, whatever it might be. So Marty Glickman was a great teacher of broadcasting, another aspect of his life.
So this all resonated for me, starting at the very beginning. My grandparents came from Romania.
As did Glickman, right?
Right. So they settled in the Bronx, and of course, I also had family in Brooklyn. My dad played sports, tennis and baseball. He played baseball at James Monroe in the Bronx with Hank Greenberg.
Really?
Yeah. And so
you know what? We're family. We're family because my mother played handball with Hank Greenberg at the Castle Hill Beach Club, a beach club that had no beach. Okay.
Right.
And she said that he was a great baseball player, but a lousy handball player. So Hank Greenberg, sure, James Monroe High School was right near where I grew up in Parkchester, just a couple of train stations away. So we are, as we say in Yiddish, Landsmen. We are people of the same background. That's a nice touch.
Absolutely. We'll have to talk about this more because my father played handball at Castle Hill. So
is that right? That's where my absolutely. Parents met in 1936, right?
It's amazing. So we loved baseball, but we also followed football and followed track. I actually went to high school with Bob Beeman, 1968.
Jamaica.
Yep, in Jamaica High School. So this all resonated, and I was glad it was recommended to me, and I'm glad we got a chance to talk. And it was great fun to read. And you mentioned Marty Glickman was 5'8". I don't remember if you mentioned that in the book, but just to think about not only his track career, but in high school and college, being a football star at the height of 5'8", that's astounding today.
Well, he had one advantage. Well, two things. One, when he was in high school, he played a Brooklyn high school championship game against Sid Luckman, from Erasmus Hall. He went to James Madison, of course. They played in Ebbets Field in front of 20,000 fans. 20,000 fans. The game was so important that newsreels in movie theaters around the country could watch it. And if people are interested, there's like a 15-second, 20-second YouTube video of Marty playing football in high school. When he's recruited to Syracuse, they also recruit a fellow named Al Handler, who was a blocking back. So they were smart enough to recruit a Jewish blocker and a Jewish running back. And he said, you know what? When I played football in high school, nobody called me any names because I had a multi-ethnic group of people blocking for him. But he could certainly run. And he, in his early years as a broadcaster, he would work out with the New York Knicks and the Giants. Wow. He'd race with some of the players, and he very often beat them. So, again, sportscaster, athlete, and of course, an American Jew.
And a gracious gentleman. And a gracious gentleman.
And a gracious gentleman, too. Absolutely.
So you're a serious scholar. You're an author with an extensive list of books to your credit. What are you reading now professionally, and what do you read for fun, and do they overlap?
I only read nonfiction. It drives my wife crazy. Okay. My most recent book, I'm reading a biography called From Left to Right. It is a biography of one of the first female Holocaust historians who grew up in the Bronx on Marshall Parkway. Her name was Lucy Davidowitz, and who was a spokesman for communism in America, socialism in America in the 1930s. And then after the war, she turns and becomes a neoconservative. So that sort of work interests me. One other book that I just finished reading, which is very comparable to what I did, but in a different way. Matthew Goodman did a book called City Game. It's a chronicle. It's a history of the 1951 basketball scandal in New York City, which involved City College, that great scandal that changed the whole face of college basketball in New York City. And Howard, I went to City College, as you mentioned, and I went there 16 years after the great scandal. And we say in Jewish culture about the destruction of the temple, the holy temple in Jerusalem, we say in Hebrew, Zecher l'Churban. We always remember the destruction. 16 years after the 51 scandal, people at City College still remembered how great we were as a basketball program and what happened to us, getting involved with gamblers, getting involved with the underworld, getting involved with criminality. And the sad part about it is we had a great team of basketball players. And Matthew Goodman's book tells the story of the City Game, how in 1950, City College won the double championship. And along the way, by the way, maybe not by the way, they beat the University of Kentucky. A team of blacks and Jews beat Kentucky, coached by Adolph Rupp. Adolph Rupp comes to New York, Adolph Rupp in 1950, and loses to Jews and blacks. Then 51 is the scandal. Matt Goodman tells that book very, very well. So those are two books, very, very different, that I read recently that I recommend. And I think that tells a lot about my interest and how it intersects with sports and American Jewish history.
Absolutely. It's wonderful. I'm going to look for both. And so I unfortunately don't know a lot about my grandfather, who I mentioned came to America from Romania. He opened a music and radio store in 1923, so 100 years ago this year. And I've done some research, and I've done a little bit of writing to commemorate the 100th anniversary. The footnotes in your book are just wonderful. And I've got to pursue, follow up on some of the references as I further explore my grandfather's life in the first part of the 1900s. So I thank you for that, and I look forward to doing
that. Well, you're
that.
Welcome, man. I was fortunate to have an outstanding genealogist work with me, taking the story back to Romania. And it's also good to have a research assistant, a college student at Yeshiva University, we went through all the references to Glickman, both in the New York Times and Jewish newspapers, and also the Brooklyn Eagle. That was the hometown paper of sure. Marty Glickman, and literally hundreds of references, many of them to his sports experience and to his broadcasting experience. So we delved into a wealth of material and supplemented by all these interviews, which I enjoyed so much doing. Get a chance to speak to Bill Walton. Can't do much better than that.
Absolutely okay? Not.
That was so much fun doing it. So it was a joyous pursuit. And you were kind enough to mention I've done a whole bunch of other books, but this one I think is going to stay with me for the longest time. That's for sure.
That's wonderful. Thank you very much. I really appreciate you taking the time.
My pleasure. I enjoyed the conversation very, very much.
More information about our guest today can be found on our website, www.bookwormsinthewild.com, which also includes links to the books and other resources we referred to in our discussion. Thanks especially to my podcast team. Dave created the podcast with me and is my producer. Ron is responsible for art direction and design for the podcast, our website, and my bookmark. Melanie, who has designed additional swag, provides overall creative direction. Ben and Eden and Catherine provide additional inspiration and support. And, of course, Carol is my muse. 4.5-year-old, happy-go-lucky, subway car-loving Jakey remains a delight beyond words and continues to encourage the podcast, as does Jake's sweet, energetic, wisecracking, and equally delightful 2.5-year-old cousin Francesca, who always likes to tell me what she's reading. Sweet baby Mila Zora Dora joined the podcast production intern class last summer, and the three grand loves are thrilled to welcome brand new, sweet, and very little Miles Moe to the team. We're now up to 4 grand loves, and for the benefit of any of my kids who get this deep into the podcast, we have capacity to add to the team. And I'm giving out cash bonuses to any of my kids who hear this and tell me about it within 1 month after release of the podcast. Thanks to the great Spotify team for making it free and easy to create the podcast. Thanks as well to AJ Falari, who is working on the editing with me. If you liked our podcast, please subscribe. And in any event, let me have your comments, either directly on the podcast or at bookwormsinthewild@gmail.com. Looking forward to seeing you on the podcast next time.